Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guests this morning on Two Jewish are Eric Lindberg and Donnie Zasloff of the bluegrass group Nefesh Mountain. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our Two Jewish maven on Israel, Amir Eden, and our Shin Shinim Chen Nenachi and Tamir Shakuri. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. Last week I began a Two Jewish summer excursion on the theme of learning, Jewish learning, since this is a time of year when life slows down for many of us and gives us the opportunity to explore new avenues for growth. Last week I suggested taking 10 minutes a day to read a chapter of Torah, beginning with the book of Deuteronomy, Dvarim, which is read in synagogues over the course of the summer. This morning, I want to suggest something very few Jews have really taken the time to do in any kind of systematic way, reading the rest of the Bible beyond the Torah. This may come as a surprise to our non-Jewish listeners, but most of us American Jews have never actually read the entire Tanakh, the Hebrew Bible, in either English or Hebrew. Although some of us have a pretty decent familiarity with the first five books, the Torah, you know, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, very few of us have actually taken the time to read the rest of our foundational religious text. Unlike Christians, Jews have other sacred texts of nearly equal importance, like the Talmud, the great compendium of Jewish law, lore, and learning, but still, the whole of Judaism rests to one degree or another on the Tanakh, the Hebrew Bible, what some people still call the Old Testament. And very few American Jews of any denomination, Orthodox, Conservative, Reform, Reconstructionist, Renewal, you name it, have actually read through the whole of our very own Bible. It's common among practicing Christians in America to take time for Bible study regularly, and for some American Jews, the same can be said about Torah study, offered weekly by nearly every temple on this continent. But the Torah, as amazing as it is, composes only the first five books of a text that actually includes 39 separate books, that is an additional 34 books after you finish reading the Torah. Some of those books of the Bible are quite familiar to practicing American Jews. The prophetic book of Jonah, for example, chanted and read on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, or the book of Esther, the basis for the holiday of Purim. And some parts of the book of Psalms are familiar to most American Jews. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want, say. While most American Jewish adults who have had a bar bat mitzvah know a little bit about the prophet who wrote their Haftorah, such as Isaiah or Jeremiah. But for the vast majority of Jews, including the subset who belong to synagogues in America and are reasonably observant, there are vast stretches of the latter stages of the Bible that are terra incognita. I suspect you could put a chapter from the book of Malachi or Ezekiel or Daniel or 2 Kings in front of most American Jews, and they would guess it was either a Christian text, archaic poetry, or post-apocalyptic fiction. Some people would suspect that J.R.R. Tolkien was the author, or J.K. Rowling. For a highly literate people who strive to educate our children to the greatest degree possible, we Jews often take our own tradition for granted. But that's something we can easily fix. In fact, you can start fixing it today. Just download a free version of the Tanakh. The JPS translation works well. It's on the App Store for free, by the way. And decide which prophet you're going to start reading. It is poetry, so feel free to look up that prophet on Wikipedia to get a point of reference or a context in history. But once you start reading Isaiah, say, or Jeremiah or Ezekiel, and stay with him for 15 minutes a day, you are going to discover amazing literature, great wisdom, and truly powerful words and ideas. A good way to spend your summer, no? To play us in this morning, our guests, Eric Lindberg and Donnie Zasloff of the bluegrass group Nefesh Mountain, here's their version of Psalm 121, I Lift My Eyes to the Mountains, Esa Enai.
I lift my eyes to the mountains.
Where does my help?
Where does my help?
Where does my help come from?
That was Esa Enai from our guests this morning, Eric Lindberg and Donnie Zasloff, the heart and soul of a wonderful bluegrass group, Nefesh Mountain. Meet them and find out how this remarkable style of music drew them in and drew them together, and the wonderful way they bring their Judaism into their music when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town, amazing dining, and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We welcome our guests this morning, the group Nefesh Mountain, with a little of their new recording, The Narrow Bridge.
It's not far from our homes, where the woods are turned to stones, and the feeling of wonder is nearly gone. Grows unplanned, so we just keep to the narrow bridge we're on. Troubled times, troubled times, you don't ease a worried mind. Troubled times, troubled times, just stay behind. Troubled times, troubled times, you don't ease a worried mind. Troubled times, just stay.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guests this morning, the husband and wife team, Eric Lindberg and Donnie Zasloff, who form Nefesh Mountain, a wonderful bluegrass group. Well, duo, I guess, is more accurate, isn't it? I think you'll love their music. You'll hear some of it sprinkled throughout Too Jewish this morning. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning.
Hi.
Good to be here.
Okay, so what kind of a job is this for nice Jewish people playing bluegrass music?
What kind of a job? Well, it's a dream kind of a job for us, because it's really it's a music that, you know, us being American Jews we feel so confidently and beautifully connected to this style of music. So it's not a stretch for us, even though I know on paper it might, you know, to some maybe it seems like kind of a novelty or something. But Donnie and I are just being ourselves, and it's really a dream job to be able to play American musical forms and write for that style with our beautiful heritage as Jewish Americans.
You know, I have to say, there are so many wonderful combinations available musically today within Jewish music, but some of them often, well, how can I say this delicately? Some of them feel less than fully authentic. They're mashups. It's not that they're not fun or they're not great explorations. Your stuff feels incredibly authentic to me. Tell us a little bit about your background in bluegrass, how you guys got into it, and who your mentors were.
Okay, sure. Well, first of all, thank you. I think that we both are, and I credit my wife for this, that she is so authentic in herself, and I try to follow behind closely in her footsteps. But if there's anything that we try to do, it is try to be authentic and not put anything out there to the world that really isn't, because we're just wasting everyone's time. But in the bluegrass world, my heroes, I grew up hearing all of the greats, and many of which are actually on our albums, which I'm so proud to say. Guys like Sam Bush and Jerry Douglas, Tony Trischka, David Greer, Rob Ikes, you know, the guys that have, Mark Schatz for sure, that have shaped the course of bluegrass music over and over again since the late 60s and 70s. But of course, Earl Scruggs and Bill Monroe, and just the whole history of bluegrass itself, to me, has been a big part of my musical life. But I've also been really interested to trace that back, as well as a lot of other roots musicians have wanted to trace that back to, or where did bluegrass come from? And of course, there's the old story where Bill Monroe was influenced heavily by his uncle Penn, who used to play old-time fiddle on the porch down there on Jerusalem Ridge on the property. And so bring that real old Scotch-Irish tradition to the fore. But nowadays, the more that scholars and historians look into bluegrass music, we realize that there's way more influence from African countries, and the influence of the banjo, which came from Africa, and that kind of that roots musical idea was hugely influential in American music.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just Celtic music imported to Appalachia. It's got a really interesting African overlay. Donnie, what brought you to bluegrass?
Well, I've always loved the sound of it. Really when Eric and I started writing together, we also happened to be falling in love. It was sort of our love story, the love story of us. And it just kind of, everything we started to write came out like this. I mean, it just felt very authentic and very real. And, you know, bluegrass for me has such a sound of, it's a spiritual, you know, old time and bluegrass is spiritual music. So it felt like a natural fit. We weren't doing anything that hadn't been done, you know, from a spiritual perspective. We just were coming in at it with a Jewish background. So it was a natural, and I think bluegrass has like ruach in it when it's like the big sounds and the big, you know, you sort of have to get up and dance sometimes when you hear bluegrass.
Yeah, it's sort of American klezmer somehow. That's the analogy I think of.
Totally. It has this like upbeat, contagious vibe. But then the slower, more, the sweeter, like some of the old time and bluegrass sounds are also very pure and authentic and very lonesome and very have a little bit of sadness, which I think we have in our history as well, and a lot of questioning. And it just all felt like a perfect match. And combined with Eric being my soulmate and falling in love, it just happened. It sort of happened before we even knew it is the only way I can explain it.
That's great. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear more from our guests, Nefesh Mountain, and we'll hear some of their music as well. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or a kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's twojewishradio18@gmail. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. We welcome our maven on Israel, Amir Eden, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Amir.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
And I should say, bon voyage. you're off for Nisya Tova, a great trip. You're going back to Israel.
Correct.
Going home. Tell us a little bit about the purpose of this trip. I know you go back and forth reasonably frequently, but this is special for a couple of reasons.
As you know, Rabbi, I just joined our community here in Tucson in March. As soon as I came, we had major projects such as Israel Independence, obviously before Yom HaZikaron, the Memorial Day. So there were a lot of planning, a lot of work with amazing groups. Now I'm focusing on actually learning about our partnership, and I'm going there to meet our partners, our Israeli partners.
Whom you haven't met before, right?
Correct, yeah. So
that's in the south, Chof Ashkelon and Kiryat Malachi, both of them not too far from Gaza, actually.
Not at all. Actually, some of the people that I'm going to meet, they live on the border, like 2 meters away.
Mm.
Yeah.
So that should be an extremely interesting trip.
Very interesting.
I spent a little time down there myself, and a fascinating area, wonderful people. Not an unpressured area of Israel, is it?
True, yeah. So obviously I've been in the region many times as an Israeli wearing different hats, but this time I'm coming with the Tucson hat. So I'm going to meet the mayor and of both areas. I'm going to meet their lay leaders, professionals, and the people. And one day is with my own family to meet families. And all the other days, I'm going to be a full week there. And the other days are just by myself, professional meetings, planning ahead, learning, and see what we can do better to strengthen the bridge between us and them.
Fantastic. Now, you also have a very important personal reason to be in Israel.
Correct. My son, Niv, is celebrating his bar mitzvah. Thank you. He's been studying very hard with Rabbi Yossi Shochat of Chabad in Las Vegas.
Okay.
As you know, my family is still in Vegas.
Las Vegas, right.
And so we're very excited, very, very excited, very proud of his work.
But so your oldest son had his bar mitzvah on Masada,
correct,
right?
Yeah, Masada.
Which is a famous place. This time you're doing something different.
Yes, so this time, and truly it's my son's decision and adventure. He searched Israeli sites that he wants to celebrate a bar mitzvah, and found an amazing place. And we went together as a family to Tzipori, which is a very old site.
It's a famous Sanhedrin place, Sepphoris in Talmudic times and
correct,
before.
Correct.
It has a magnificent
times,
synagogue there. It goes back to Roman
synagogue,
times.
Beautiful synagogue, yeah. Correct. So we're going to be there.
No, that's in the north.
It's in the north. And what's nice to share is that it's truly a very meaningful experience for us as a family.
Mm-hmm.
What we do is the service, and that's it.
Right.
So, no DJ and parties and da-da-da-da.
Right.
It's everything is led by the teen, by my son. He planned everything, and, we support him, of course, but it's his show.
He's really becoming a man. He's taking care of everything.
Yes, and it's going to be very intimate. It's like 15 people, 1-5. That's it.
That's fantastic. Yes. And that's really an exciting trip. So he's planned his own bar mitzvah. You're going back there for that. And
I want to add one thing. People ask me if I volunteer. And of course, I volunteer in many organizations because it's important to myself and to my family. My older son is going to spend a full week at a vacation with Bet Ashanti Bamidbar, which is a village for youth at risk.
Mm-hmm.
So he again decided that he wants to spend a week and work there and serve.
And then that's his service commitment. That's
something,
fantastic.
Something
yeah.
that he does. And then the younger one, Niv, asked that his gifts will not go to his bank account, but he chose a place, an organization that the gifts are going to go there.
So
and that's Sachi, which is Sayeret Chesed Yichudit. So basically, it's an amazing organization in Israel that has many branches. And the goal is to serve those who are in need by getting food, buying food, and just providing it to families who struggle to feed their children.
Incredibly inspirational, great lesson, and listen, a wonderful trip, and look forward
Thank
to seeing
you
when you come back.
Thank you, Rabbi.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We started talking last week about some of the very far-flung Jewish communities on the major trade routes that ran all the way from Iberia, southwestern Europe to China in the Middle Ages. I wrote a senior thesis at UCLA a long time ago on somebody called, on a group called the Radenites, who were Jewish merchant travelers who ran, who traded all through the darkest period of the Middle Ages, even before the Crusades. It's fascinating. Like, how were they able to do this at a time when most people in Europe didn't travel more than 10 or 20 miles from their birthplace in their entire lives? Here were people traveling 2, 3, 4, 5 year journeys long before Marco Polo, all the way across the world.
Right. And some settled permanently in what became major Jewish centers like Bukhara and Samarkand and these places which have historic Jewish communities that go back many centuries, their own traditions, their own melodies, their own customs,
their own clothing styles, well established.
Right? I mean, no Jewish community in the world is permanent, but these are as close as you can get to permanent communities. So really, as we concluded last week's session, there's two questions. One is the why, and one is the how.
Right.
And a big part of the how has to do with Genghis Khan and the Mongol hordes, so-called. And it's interesting how history has changed our image of the Mongol hordes and Genghis Khan. More contemporary views back in the 13th, 14th, 15th centuries, even English playwrights like Christopher Marlowe described the Mongolians as highly civilized people.
Yeah, like his play about Tamerlane.
Right. And so the question is, were they? What did they accomplish? And why is our view of them so highly negative today? So this is an interesting sub-question, but it's closely related to this question of Jewish traders moving along these vast trade routes between the Far East and Southwestern Europe. So Genghis Khan and his sons and ultimately grandsons established an empire that went from Vietnam to Poland and from the Korean Peninsula to the Sinai. The biggest empire the world has ever seen.
Gigantic.
Under one rule.
Gigantic.
And one of the things they assured in their first, let's say, 100 years in power was that it was safe to travel anywhere in their empire, even for single women. There was not an issue of highwaymen, robbers, brigands, whatever. It was safe. And not only was it safe, but they introduced a precursor to modern day things like passports, which didn't exist then, credit cards, universal education, things that are very far advanced, considering that we're talking about the 13th and 14th century. One of the hows that Jewish traders could use was the safety and the portable credit established by the Mongols over this vast empire.
But the other
question is, why do we have such a negative image of the Mongols today? Well, they did, in cities that refused to surrender, cause a lot of damage. They were fairly brutal.
The mountains of skulls that are described.
Right. But they weren't brutal to philosophers, clergy, artists, intellectuals. They carted them off to Karakoram, their capital, and they made that a world center of learning and ecumenicism and, you know, let the best man win in terms of civil arguments. Looks like we have to continue next week, so we'll come back to this, for me at least, fascinating subject.
Fascinating subject, Tom. I'll also tell you that there were Jewish contracts that go back to the 9th, 10th, and 11th century called commenda contracts that even predated that, and we'll talk about that next week too. Thanks, Tom.
Look forward to it.
We welcome our Shin Shinim on Israel, Tamir Shakuri and Chaim Dinachi. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov.
So this has been a tough period in the press and in public opinion for Israel over the last few months with events in Gaza. Speaking as young Israelis who are living here, working here, tell us a little bit about your experience of what you've heard, what you've seen, what you feel.
Well, it has been a very, very tense couple weeks, even months, and it's been weird. I mean, my brother's in the military, so I'm always concerned about that. But even more so, like, being here outside of Israel, it's kind of a different experience because you get to see what the rest of the world sees it like. and you get to see like the news from a different perspective and like the press. And I feel like Israel really does get a bad rap. And living in Israel, I didn't necessarily feel like it. Because I didn't agree with everything Israel did. And I didn't realize how like not very well it is represented. Like, I don't feel like it gets appropriate coverage.
How inaccurately and sometimes how biased the approach is.
Yeah, very, very, like, perspective takes a very big part in news here. So I feel like I kind of felt that. And I feel like my country is not being done justice because, I don't know, I feel like people are very, very quick to judge. And it's fine having an opinion that's not necessarily positive about Israel. I obviously, it is my country and I love it and I will stand behind it. But there are moves that I feel like are not something I would choose to do. I do think, however, that people are very, very quick to assume bad things. And it's kind of like, I mean, every country has its dirty laundry, except ours is like hung to dry in front of the whole neighborhood and
maybe the whole world.
The whole world. So I don't know. I feel like maybe before automatically saying, wow, that shirt is very, very disgusting, or wow, that move was really bad and the military shouldn't have done that, people should really like think, yeah, well, maybe my military does the same and I just don't know. Because I feel like no conflict is getting more coverage in the Western world right now. It is so like covered and just very, very,
very public and nonstop coverage. That's a great point. Tamir, you had a couple thoughts.
I usually get my information from the Israeli press, because I feel like Israel right now is going towards a direction that is very liberal, and that different newspapers and different websites show opinions that you can see in America. And hearing it in Hebrew, first of all, makes me understand it better, much better, because I want to be fully aware of what the situation is. And also, I get my information from my family. I live in the north, so in the south, sorry. So that means that...
You've been here too long. You've forgotten where you live in Israel.
No, I know where I live. I just, the direction's mixed up. I live in the south, and that's close to the Gaza Strip. And there were a couple of alarms in the past couple of months. And so I wanted to make sure that my friends and family are safe and that we're not getting into that phase again. I remember being a fifth grader running to shelter in the middle of the shower or in the middle of the night. And it's not a pleasant experience. And... even though a lot of things seem very black or white, like Chen said, there's a lot behind it that people don't necessarily see if you don't come from the country that really has people that are 18 standing on the border protecting our country and making sure that the civilians inside are safe at all means.
At all times.
Right? At all times. So I think that it really is a tough situation to judge from the outside when you're not really looking at it from a side in the conflict, because it's really easy to just say that everything's okay.
Thank you both for being so open about it, and we'll talk next week.
Thank you.
And now it's time for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Rachel and her husband Max are in their local kosher restaurant. As usual, within moments of taking their seats, Rachel starts to call over the waiter. "Waiter," she says, "please turn up the air conditioning. You know, I can't stand the hot atmosphere." 5 minutes later, she calls the waiter over again. "Waiter," she says, "now it's freezing in here. Please to turn down the air conditioning. It's too cold." 5 minutes after that, she wants it turned up again because she's getting too hot. "Waiter, it's boiling like chicken soup. Please turn down the air conditioning." Finally, food arrives at the table, and Rachel says to the waiter, "Again, it's too cold in here. Waiter, please turn up the air conditioning." A guy sitting at a nearby table can't help but notice the amazing patience of the waiter. Calls him over quietly. "Look, waiter," he says, "you are incredible. Why don't you just throw her out of the restaurant?" "Oh, we don't really mind," says the waiter. "Because not only do we believe the customer is always right, but also this restaurant doesn't have air conditioning."
That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. Reminds me of a time when the air conditioning in my synagogue was driving everyone nuts. I said, look, if you are too cold right now, raise your hand. And about a third of the people raised their hands. I said, okay, put your hands down. If you're too hot right now in the sanctuary, raise your hand. And another third of the people raised their hands. I said, okay, trade places. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Balak in the book of Numbers, which includes some of the best words an outsider ever delivered about our people. In the portion, one of just two in the whole Torah named after a non-Jew, by the way, 40 years of wandering have passed, and the Israelites have finally arrived on the borders of the land of Canaan. They're about to move in, and they seem unstoppable to their opponents. Balak, king of Moab, comes up with a novel plan. He will hire Balaam, a pagan sorcerer, to curse the Israelites, which will destroy their chances of defeating his own army and entering his land. Only the scheme doesn't work. Balaam may be a polytheistic prophet, but he's also an honest man who conveys only what God permits him to say. After consulting the Almighty, Balaam agrees to do the deed, but only if God allows him to do so. And so, we are given the intriguing spectacle of Balaam the sorcerer three times trying to curse the people of Israel, only to discover that the words that come out of his mouth are not curses, but blessings. The last of these orations by Balaam is a text that has become a prayer we use whenever we enter a synagogue. Matovu ohalecha Yaakov, how good are your tents, O Jacob, your homes, Israel. Somehow, the best laid plans of Israel's enemies go awry, transformed by the hand of God. Without being deterministic, we know that in recent decades, many nations and organizations have planned the destruction of our people and of our country, Israel. Although their efforts have injured us, ultimately, we have triumphed. Perhaps more importantly, the personal message of this portion of Balak is a subtle one. Usually in life, we intend to bring blessing, but often bring tsoros, trouble instead. But if we rely on God's help and inspiration, we will find that even our less than nobly motivated actions bring blessing in the place of curses. It's all a matter of remembering the true source for inspiration and creativity and therefore of blessing, which is God. When we return on Too Jewish, our guests, the remarkable musicians behind the outstanding bluegrass group Nefesh Mountain, will explain what it is about this very American music that expresses Jewish themes and ideas so beautifully. Find out from Eric Lindberg and Donnie Zasloff how they make it all work when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The legal fight over ownership of the Touro Synagogue in Newport, Rhode Island, America's oldest synagogue, is headed to the U.S. Supreme Court. The first U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals last week denied a petition filed by Congregation Yeshuat Israel, which worships in the historic synagogue in Newport, for a rehearing of a ruling from last August that said it was just a tenant. That ruling by a three-judge panel found that New York's Sherit Israel, which was founded in 1654, is the rightful owner of the Touro Synagogue, built in the year 1763. Yeshuat Israel will appeal this latest decision, according to its lawyer, Gary Naftalis. This is the latest development in a years-long property dispute between Yeshuat Israel and Sherit Israel of New York. That's the nation's oldest congregation, by the way. The appeals court ruling by Justice David Souter, the former U.S. Supreme Court justice, also grants the Manhattan congregation ownership of some of Touro's possessions. We will seek review by the United States Supreme Court to continue our fight to preserve the Touro Synagogue, Naftalis said. He added that Yeshuat Israel is the only congregation that has prayed at Touro for over a century. But Louis Solomon, board chair of Sherit Israel and its lawyer in the case against Yeshuat Israel, said the court's decision reaffirms the need for the good of American Jewry and people of faith everywhere to put this divisive matter behind us. The two congregations have had a close, centuries-old intertwined relationship. During the Revolutionary War, when Newport's Jews fled the city because of the threat of the British Army, Sherith Israel became the trustee of the Touro Synagogue and for a time held its possessions. The current legal dispute dates back 6 years to 2012, when Yeshua Israel, seeking to secure its financial footing and maintain a rabbi in Newport, Rhode Island, planned to sell artifacts worth millions of dollars. Sherith Israel moved to block the sale, arguing that it is the rightful owner of the Touro Synagogue and its possessions. 2 years ago, a U.S. District Court judge in Providence, Rhode Island, ruled in favor of Yeshua Israel and removed Sherith Israel as a trustee. Sherith Israel appealed and won the decision in August, with Souter finding that Yeshua Israel was a tenant. Yeshua Israel then appealed and lost last week. The intended sale that sparked the conflict was of a pair of colonial-era silver Torah scroll finials handcrafted by prominent silversmith Meyer Myers, valued at more than $7 million. Designated a National Historic Site in 1946, the Touro Synagogue attracts tens of thousands of visitors each year. I've actually gone there and been part of that, including for its annual summertime reading of the historic letter from George Washington, who visited the Touro Synagogue in the year 1790. The nation's first president wrote that the government gives to bigotry no sanction, to persecution no assistance, a famous phrase. In other news, the Israeli military struck a vehicle belonging to the leader of the terror cell in Gaza that sends burning kites and balloons over the border into southern Israel, causing arson fires that have destroyed thousands of acres of Israeli agricultural lands and woodlands. No one was injured in the airstrike by the IDF. The strike was in response to a series of arson and explosive kites and balloons that have been launched into Israel, the IDF said recently. The Israeli military has warned numerous times against these launches. These are acts of terror that endanger Israeli residents living in southern Israel. The IDF is determined to continue to act with increasing intensity against these acts of terror. The Hamas terror organization is responsible for everything that happens in and from the Gaza Strip, and it will suffer the consequences, the Israeli military also said. That same day, they fired warning shots at a group of Gaza Palestinians preparing to launch more incendiary kites and balloons towards Israel. 30 fires were ignited in southern Israel last weekend alone by incendiary kites and balloons damaging crops. At least 11 fires were started a week ago Friday, the Muslim holy day of Eid al-Fitr, which comes after the month-long Ramadan fast. Hamas had threatened to launch 5,000 burning kites and balloons at Israel on Eid. 11 is not quite 5,000, but it is destructive, and it is terrorism. Fire and Rescue Services Commissioner Brigadier General Didi Simchi said kites launched from Gaza have caused 412 blazes over the past 75 days. Damage has been estimated at about 1,235 acres of wheat, avocado orchards, jojoba, and agricultural equipment, costing about $2 million. In truly depressing news, former Israeli cabinet minister Gonen Segev has been charged with spying for Israel, Israel's Shin Bet Internal Security Service said last week. The former energy and infrastructure minister, who has also spent time in jail for drug smuggling, was arrested on suspicion of committing offenses by assisting the enemy in a time of war, spying against the state of Israel, and providing intelligence to the enemy. Segev is suspected of providing Iranian handlers with intelligence relating to Israel's energy industry and security sites, as well as about buildings and officials in Israeli political and security bodies. According to the Shin Bet, Segev arrived in Equatorial Guinea in May of this year for a visit, but he was refused entry to the country due to his criminal past in Israel. He was subsequently extradited to Israel at the request of the Israeli police and arrested for questioning by the Shin Bet immediately after his arrival. They found that Segev was recruited and acted as an agent on behalf of Iranian intelligence. In 2012, Segev first met with elements of the Iranian embassy in Nigeria and later traveled twice to Iran to meet handlers. Segev received a secret communication system to encrypt messages between himself and his Iranian handlers, met with them in hotels and apartments used for clandestine Iranian activity around the world. In order to perform this espionage treason for Iran, Segev maintained ties with Israeli citizens connected to Israel's security and foreign relations. He tried to connect some of the Israeli citizens to Iranian intelligence, all the while presenting his Iranian handler as an innocent businessman. Segev was born in Israel in 1956. He was a pilot in the Israeli Air Force in the 70s and became a captain. Following his service, he studied medicine at Ben-Gurion University and became a doctor. He was elected to Knesset in 1992 as part of the now-defunct Hawkish Opposition Summit Party, joined then-Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin's government as energy minister in 1994, and later quit politics. Segev was arrested and convicted for drug smuggling and credit card fraud back in 2005 after attempting to bring 32,000 ecstasy tablets from the Netherlands into Israel. He was released 2 years later after serving part of a five-year sentence. Segev at the time said he thought the ecstasy tablets were M&Ms. He moved to Nigeria and practiced medicine after his license was revoked in Israel. In 2016, Segev requested that Health Minister Yaakov Litzman pardon him so he could move back to Israel and go back to practicing as a doctor. But apparently he instead went to work for the Iranian Secret Service, and now he is in prison in Israel. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guests this morning, the husband and wife team, Eric Lindberg and Donnie Zasloff. Their group, their duo, is called Nefesh Mountain, wonderful bluegrass music with a deep Jewish infusion on Jewish themes. And they have an actual, I guess you have a bluegrass Shabbat, don't you?
Yeah, well, we perform Shabbat services, both Kabbalat Shabbat, evening services, morning services. We've done all different kinds of different holidays. So our songs make their way into Shabbat services for sure.
Yeah, we love to collaborate with rabbis and cantors and thread the bluegrass. You know, we have melodies for the entire Shabbat service that we thread throughout, and it's really a beautiful experience for us.
Now, some of those are on your album, but you haven't released like a bluegrass Shabbat album yet, I understand.
No,
not yet.
Well, maybe that should be next.
Maybe.
We have a lot of ideas in the pot.
We have a lot of albums we want to make.
That's great. I'm sorry, I was a little chutzpahdik to suggest that. Tell us a little bit about your latest album and what you decide to include and how you evolved the latest work.
Well, we're really proud of this recent album. It came out March 3rd of 2018, and it's called Beneath the Open Sky. And it's actually, that's one of the lyrics from our version of Psalm 50, which we simply titled Hallelujah, and it's on the record. And we really wanted, we had a bunch of songs that we knew were going to be on this record, and before we knew it, we had sort of a concept album. And for us, the concept is kind of a journey, and we really were really excited to write about these ups and downs that we go on through life, both as husband and wife, kind of on our own travels and our own tours, and just kind of the story of life. And there's life and death. There's some songs on there that I wrote for my grandparents and Donnie's grandparents. There's songs that are just totally celebratory. And we were trying to reach all of those kind of human things that seem to happen to all of us. And Beneath the Open Sky as a title really fit that. We're all just beings beneath this beautiful open sky in this beautiful world, and we wanted the album to feel big like that. And to record it, we went down to Nashville, which was to the same studio that we went in our first record, and we recruited the guys that I mentioned before, Sam right. Bush, Jerry Douglas, Tony Trischka, and David Greer, along with our New York band members, Alan Grubner, who's our violinist, and Tim Kaya, who's our bassist, to go down and flesh out these tunes.
I think I would also just add that this album for us is really a cry to the universe for unity, for equality. The first song is Bound for the Promised Land, which is really about hoping for a better world. And I think in light of, you know, so much that's been going on in this country and all over the world, it just felt really, we really felt deeply, you know, maybe by us doing this music in the way that we're doing it, we could change people's perceptions of what a Jew is outside of the Jewish world. You know, maybe we could open up Jewish ears to a new sound of music. Maybe we can, bring people together in a cool way. And if we could even begin to do any of those things, then that's like beyond what a musician's, dream is, really.
There's so much soul in what you do. I mean, it's kind of soul music, right?
Totally. Thank you. Yes.
Well, obviously, Nefesh Mountain, okay, it means soul, right? But
yeah.
But there, it's, you know, it obviously feels very heartfelt, and but it's also a lot of fun. So, some of this, those are high ideals, and I think it's a beautiful goal, and it's a beautiful album. Is it fun to make?
Oh my gosh.
So much fun to make.
And so much fun to play, and so much fun to be on this adventure together and sharing the music. It's dreamy, and I often, like, I feel like crying after so many of the performances, just out of complete gratitude for loving what we do. I really mean it. It's amazing. Amazing.
I want to ask you about something else. Woody Guthrie wrote a whole bunch of Jewish tunes that were discovered, I don't know, must be 7-8 years ago now. And you guys did his Hanukkah dance. That's kind of fun to do, isn't it? That's something kind of like going back to the source again, isn't it?
For sure, yeah. I mean, we're obviously, as we're, well, it may not be obvious, but we are both huge fans of Woody Guthrie's. And it only became, I only became aware of these songs recently, like you said. But it turns out, as we were digging into it, that his mother-in-law was Jewish and was a Yiddish poet.
His wife was Jewish, actually, at the time, too, right?
Right, and it was her mother that was a poet that he would, apparently they would share lyrics and all this stuff, and this is when he lived on Coney Island. And he wrote these beautiful Jewish stories and songs, and we would love to do more of them over time, but we did do two a couple Hanukkahs ago in honor of Woody, and it was really a fun project to do, and also put some different spins and some modernizations on it, and kind of, we went kind of Celtic with another one, so it was a lot of fun for sure.
Have you guys been influenced at all by traditional Jewish modes and traditional Jewish music? Not that you need to be. I mean, you're doing bluegrass, but has that influenced any of the work that you've done?
I think that growing up for me, Jewish synagogue, Jewish camp, Jewish day school, I mean, so much of what I love.
Now you have to tell us which synagogue and which camp and which day school.
Yeah, I went to Charles E. Smith Jewish Day School in D.C. and Akiba Hebrew Academy and Brandeis University. And when I went to Camp Ramah, Camp Judea, Camp B'nai B'rith.
Donna, you're just too Jewish. It's a problem. Yeah.
I know. But I think in part, you know, it's every single moment and every melody and every prayer and every song and every dance. It's just, it's all part of me, and I'm grateful for all of it. When it came down to trying to express the spirituality now with Eric and who we are and where we are in our lives as Americans and as Jews today, this felt like the most, how we wanted to say it. So it's just our expression of who we are now, if that makes any sense.
No, it does indeed. Eric, were you influenced by some of your own Jewish background?
Of course. Yeah, for sure. I will share that my father converted to Judaism before my mother, he married my mother, and this was before I was born, and my whole father's side is not Jewish still, although I grew up in Brooklyn. I grew up very Jewish, had a bar mitzvah, went to Hebrew school and all that. I didn't go to Jewish day school. I was in public school in New York, but I mention this because, and I've been digging into this a lot lately, that my father's side has this whole different past and different history that's certainly not Jewish. And when I would hang out with my father's side of the family down as a kid, they all lived in Georgia. We would go down and we would hike the Appalachian Trail and we would listen to old-time music. And certainly at the time, I was really into Southern rock as well as a guitar player. And this whole kind of concept of Americana seemed very different from that musically, and all of the modalities involved in purely American music were so different than what I experienced in synagogue. So your question is, yeah, I mean, I was for sure influenced by all of the kind of German modalities and Eastern European sounds that are in, you know, trope and different nigguns that we sing in synagogue, for sure. But that all, I never really heard it outside of synagogue. And so those worlds didn't really quite ever come together. So I was influenced them, but in a purely musical way, my soul wasn't as affected by them. And I'm only speaking for me. And I think that's why I feel personally, when we write music for Nefesh Mountain, so interested in bringing these other American and Western sounds to Jewish liturgy and just Jewish concepts as a whole and the Jewish heritage, because it's really exciting for me to feel those at the same time. And we're really lucky that when we travel this country and the world, that people come up and they have that same feeling. They're like, well, I'm from North Carolina, and this is exactly like I can go out into like a restaurant, hear the same sounds as I am on your CDs, and you're singing about Adonai. It's just, to bring those worlds together has really been transformative for people, and I'm really proud of that.
You guys have a summer tour, and you're going to a whole bunch of very Jewish places. Can you talk about the tour a little bit?
Well, it's going to be a big tour. We are so excited to, we're going to be on a really cool 2-week Colorado tour where we'll be in Vail and Aspen and lots of different venues in Denver. We're going to be at a bunch of camps. We're going to be doing shows in Cincinnati and possibly in Kentucky. We're going to be all over the place, really. If you check our website, you can spot us all over the place.
and hopefully have a chance to come hear you guys live, which must be even better than your album, right?
Aww, well, hopefully you can come see us live. and we love live shows are really magical for us. We love it.
When you're touring, what do you travel with? Obviously, there's the two of you. Is it your other two New York musicians that go with you on the trip?
Yeah, we very rarely tour just as a duo. And we started touring almost all over as just Donnie and I kind of trekking it out all over the country. But now we tour with Alan Grubner and Tim Kaya, our bass player and fiddle player from the record. And we're looking to keep even expanding that quartet maybe over the years, add some more members, because I think although Donnie and I are the kind of brains of the band and we're conceptually bringing this all to life, we love to, you know, orchestrate the music for larger groups. So on the records, there's at least six guys on every track for the most part. And we really would like to keep bringing that live experience with great musicianship all around.
Hey, it's delightful music. Your website is nefeshmountain.com, NefeshMountain.com. And people can get your albums there. Are they also available other places?
They're on Amazon, and you can stream the albums on iTunes or on Apple Music, rather, and Spotify. You can buy the album on iTunes. You can find it CD Baby. There's a bunch of places now that you can get it pretty readily. But if you can get it from the site, too, and I personally will ship it to you.
Even better.
Yeah.
Do you sign every copy of a CD, or just bless it as you send it out?
We just give it a little pat on the back and send it out.
I want to thank Nefesh Mountain for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Again, their website is nefeshmountain.com. By all means, you want to hear their music and follow their burgeoning career. Thank you so much for being here this morning on Too Jewish.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical play out from Nefesh Mountain.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Too Jewish will be Rabbi Ben Kamen, author of The Blessing of Sorrow, Turning Grief into Healing. And, of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or at our TooJewishRadio.com website. Our playout this morning comes from our guests from Nefesh Mountain, Hodeh Ani and Hallelujah. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.